This is West Virginia Morning on West Virginia Public Radio. I'm Beth Voorhees at 7:33. A website called Frack Focus has become a national clearinghouse for information about the chemicals used in fracking. But as State Impact Pennsylvania's Katie Culinary reports, transparency about those chemicals remains elusive.
This is a story about a place where big drilling meets big data. A website called Frack Focus. The site is run by an industry-supported nonprofit called the Groundwater Protection Council, a group of state regulators who oversee water quality and oil and gas development. A few years back, the group wanted to help the industry give the public answers to a burning question about the shale gas boom.
What the heck's going down these wells?
In 2011, with funding from industry groups, Frack Focus was born. Drillers could voluntarily upload lists of the chemicals used to frack wells to release natural gas. The following year, Pennsylvania began requiring operators to use the website as part of the state's new chemical disclosure law. It's one of 14 states that have delegated their public disclosure systems to Frack Focus. Now, a farmer in, say, Washington County could log onto frackfocus.org, search for a well near her cow pasture, and pull up a PDF document from the company with a list of what went downhole. But some big data geeks say that's a problem.
My name is Paul Woods, and I'm the big data wrangler at SkyTruth.
SkyTruth is a nonprofit that uses publicly available data and satellite images to monitor the impacts of the industry on the environment, all from a tiny office in Shepherdstown, West Virginia. So when the SkyTruth team learned about Frack Focus, Woods says they were psyched.
We thought, hey, this would be great. All the data's there.
But it turns out it wasn't so easy to get. Here's the problem. Drillers post their lists of chemicals as individual PDF documents for each well they frack. To mine all that data, SkyTruth would have had to open one PDF at a time and then copy and paste all the information about each ingredient into a spreadsheet. Woods colleague David Manthos says it was a daunting task.
We calculated it was about 6 years worth of labor and just a minimum wage would have been something on the order of $90,000 just to manually do this whole thing.
So Woods designed a bot, a software program that could do all the work for them. Every night, the bot scraped the site for all the available PDFs and compiled the information into a searchable database. And with Frack Focus's permission, SkyTruth published that database in 2012. It turns out they weren't the only ones interested in this information.
We were overwhelmed by the response of people contacting us, asking questions about the data set, downloading it, and then the subsequent reports and publications that used that data set to say very interesting things.
The Smithsonian used it to make an interactive map of shale gas wells across the country. Even a consulting firm that does data analysis for the industry tapped into SkyTruth's database. But one night last June, the bot hit a roadblock.
The first thing we noticed, there was no new data coming in. There was a little error message that was coming out that said, hey, you're sending too many requests. You're being blocked for 24 hours. And then they block you for 48 hours, and then they block you forever.
The Groundwater Protection Council, the nonprofit that runs Frack Focus, had set up a system to block automated programs like SkyTruth's bot. The council says it was to prevent bots from slowing down traffic to the site. Remember the farmer with the cow pasture living near a gas well? The Groundwater Protection Council says that's who Frack Focus was meant for, not groups like SkyTruth looking for big data on drilling. The council wouldn't agree to a recorded interview, but we spoke with Associate Director Dan Yates, who explained that to get companies to voluntarily disclose what's in their fracking fluid, the council had to agree it would only serve up the data one well at a time. Yates admits that's up for reconsideration, in part because those 14 states have required drillers to use the website. Frack Focus has come under new scrutiny as the Obama administration considers whether to use it as a disclosure tool for fracking on public lands.
I think there are a number of interests being represented by Frack Focus, and I think those who manage the database are having to juggle a lot of those interests.
Kate Konchnick is director of the Environmental Policy Initiative at Harvard Law School. In a report last year, Konchnick gave Frack Focus a failing grade as a disclosure tool. She found that the data were often inaccurate and that companies were making trade secret claims for chemicals at one well site while fully disclosing the same chemicals at another.
Not maybe as robust a tool as one would hope if something is regulated or required by state law.
Konchnick says the pressure is on the Groundwater Protection Council. The council says it's open to change and is already working to fix some of the site's limitations. So what became of SkyTruth's efforts to get the data? It's been just over a year since the bot was blocked from the site. Paul Woods says,
We're stalled.
In the spring, SkyTruth teamed up with another environmental nonprofit called Frack Tracker, based in Pittsburgh, to try to work things out with the site's administrators. So far, no deal. Today, Frack Focus has records for more than 70,000 wells. Data miners are frustrated that the big information inside Frack Focus has been purposefully made so small. Samantha Malone from Frack Tracker puts it this way.
Imagine trying to understand your financial spending throughout the year by taking photos of all of your receipts of anything you ever purchased the entire year. You would need to look at each one at a time, and even then you still couldn't see the big picture.
Without big data, Woods from SkyTruth says, even individual homeowners can't see the big picture of how the shale boom is impacting them or their communities.
The kind of people who are going to answer those questions for you are people like us. And if we can't get the data because they only want to give it to individual homeowners about their individual wells, then they haven't really accomplished public disclosure.
Katie Colinari, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
This is West Virginia Morning. It's 7:40. A flash flood watch is in effect for most of the state until 1 a.m. tomorrow. It excludes the extreme northern and eastern panhandle counties. Rain and thunderstorms in our forecast through Monday.
Support for West Virginia Public Radio is provided by State Electric Supply Company, your full-line electrical supply distributor. Online at stateelectric.com.
The blacksmith is one of the most enduring figures from the early days of American history. The art form calls to mind strength, ingenuity, and craftsmanship, fire, iron, and sweat. But in the age of technology and 3D printers, what's to become of this time-tested trade? Sarah Lowther Hensley visited one West Virginia state park that's taking steps to forge new interest in traditional arts.
On this cool for mid-August day, Prickett Sports State Park, coals in this blacksmith shop are burning hot and bright, fanned by bursts of air from a ginormous bellows suspended from the ceiling. Most days, this is where you would encounter a park employee demonstrating the art of blacksmithing. But today, a group of students is getting the chance to try the craft as part of a three-day hands-on workshop.
I'm Jim Mays, living in Farmington right now, from East Side originally, Fairmont. This is on my bucket list I wanted to do, so I thought I'd get a chance to get it done.
Mays is a retired steel worker who did construction and ran heavy equipment in the coal mines. He has a small forge at home and is taking the class in hopes of learning a new skill. He watches closely as the instructor demonstrates techniques.
Several things I want to try to make. He's a good teacher. Got a lot of patience.
The patient instructor is Greg Bray, executive director of Prickett's Fort. Bray first learned the craft at the Augusta Heritage Center at Davis and Elkins College. He's now earned his living as a blacksmith for more than 20 years, but he can remember that initial learning curve.
This is the beginning class, and they all struggle just a little bit. It gets frustrating for them. It was frustrating for me when I started. And I tell that story every time I start a class, new class, and I tell how frustrated I was and how I almost didn't pursue it. That kind of helps them out a little bit.
My name is Chuck Huff. I'm from Fayetteville, Georgia. It is challenging. I mean, it's a little harder than I thought, but you learn a lot. It's very interesting, but difficult.
Use your tongs. Take your time. Don't get in no big hurry, because if you start hurrying and rushing around, these things are going to flop around. They're going to move around, and you're not going to get anything accomplished.
My name's Ed Harris. I'm from Reeseville, West Virginia. And I'm taking the class several reasons. A new hobby, to make something My wife's into crafts, and she likes the 17th, 18th century decorations. I said, well, I see if I can make them.
What's your favorite part of the class so far?
The challenge of learning something new with my hands and seeing the art. The art form.
Generating enthusiasm for the art form and for the past is one of the goals of the workshop. But Bray says there's another reason, and that is to make sure this type of opportunity is available in the future.
If you don't pass this on, if you don't find people that care about it and want to try it and want to do it, then it's going to be lost. And we're seeing that in our staffing today because there's not a lot of new people coming up. I mean, we're all getting older out here at the forts, and we're not seeing new people coming up.
Bray is encouraged by the response to the workshops. He offers them two or three times a year. One gentleman who's taken the blacksmithing workshop twice stopped by today to visit the fort. Bob Minnie recruited his Army buddy, Chuck Huff, to come up for the class. Minnie regrets not learning these skills from his grandfather and father, but says he's very glad that Prickett's Ford is taking up the slack and teaching all sorts of traditional arts and trades skills to the current generation.
And I recommend learn to do things with your hands. Get back to not just buying and throwing away, but repair and make things, and it's satisfying. It's good for the soul. That's all.
The whole thing's a process, and if I keep you on the same thing over and over again, you're going to get aggravated. Yeah. So I try to mix it up, but it's a process, so give it a shot.
For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Sarah Lowther Hensley at Prickett's Fort State Park.
Tim O'Brien and Daryl Scott are two of roots music's most formidable singer and songwriters. Here they've joined forces for It All Comes Down to Love on this Mountain Stage Song of the Week.
Thank you. about a broken heart. The remedy's the same as a breaking, telling us all what we already know.
And Daryl Scott with It All Comes Down to Love from their collaboration album, Memories and Moments. You can hear this song again and more music Saturday night at 8 on Mountain Stage, right here on West Virginia Public Radio. West Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. Keep up with all the latest West Virginia news throughout the day on our website, wvpublic.org. Support for our news bureaus comes from Shepherd University, West Virginia University, Marshall University, and Concord University. West Virginia Morning is produced with the assistance of Suzanne Higgins, Clark Davis, Jessica Lilly, Glennis Board, Dave Mistich, Roxy Todd, Sarah Lowther-Hensley, and Liz McCormick. Our theme music is by Matt Jackfert. Our producer is Ashton Mara. Our director is Teresa Wills. I'm Beth Voorhees.